Welcome to Nature-backed podcast of Single Earth. In this series, we are talking with investors about their vision of the new green world. My name is Tarmo Virki, and in this episode, I'm talking with Nina Gunell from Open Ocean. Enjoy the show.
Hey there, I'm Merit, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Single Earth, and we are building a nature-backed currency to empower you to fight against climate change and biodiversity loss. Sign up at single.earth and be among the first to switch to a truly sustainable, nature-based economy. And don't forget to join the discussion around climate change and biodiversity loss on our Discord channel. Enjoy the show.
Hi Nina, thanks for joining us at the Nature-backed.
Hi Tarmo, thank you for having me.
You're coming from Open Ocean. Most people in Helsinki know what Open Ocean is, but tell to our listeners how their fund was set up and what's the logic behind the Open Ocean.
Definitely. We were founded in 2009, and in the beginning, the founders were from MySQL and MariaDB, both database companies that are used by a large majority of software across the globe. So they were both investors and founders and operators that then founded Open Ocean. And because of that, from the really beginning, the focus has always been B2B software that is on the surface. It needs to be super easy to use and easy to love for the end user. But then when looking beneath the hood, there should be a technical differentiation. So because of that, often the founders need to have some more technical background in the companies that we invest. So it can be in data infrastructure, artificial intelligence, or intelligent software automation, for example.
So a lot of kind of the deep software focus.
Exactly. Maybe not really on the academic research side, but the stage that is immediately after that. Mm.
But MySQL was a database company, right? And
yes.
It was sold to Sun, if I remember correctly, or Oracle.
Oracle, yes.
Oracle. Or was it so that it was sold to Sun first and then Sun was sold to Oracle or something like that?
Yes. In my understanding, it was sold to Oracle.
Okay. I remember as a journalist covering those sales stories at the time years and years ago. The... you said that these are the focus areas. Which stage you invest in the companies?
We invest in late seed or A stage.
Okay.
So typically when a company has 500,000 to 1,000,000 in ARR, and we invest across Europe.
Okay. Not US or Asia or?
No. We have currently one or two investments in US, but our core focus area is in Europe.
Okay.
There can be companies that have originated in Europe and then moved to the US, of course.
Okay. And typical tickets are?
From 1 to 5 million.
Okay. So, money you typically have in your pocket, but already kind of serious capital in the companies.
Exactly. So there have typically been somebody who has invested before us when it was more towards an idea. We come in at the stage when the unit economics are at the stage that you actually can then scale the company to the next stage.
Okay, cool. The how does the kind of the whole climate, green, ESG sector play into the kind of traditionally data heavy or data focused investment fund?
Yeah, that's a super great question. And immediately when people are thinking about it, you wouldn't maybe see the connection being that dramatic, but actually it is, because there is all of the software that we're using today are using a lot of resources, i.e. then electricity that gives them GHG emissions. So in that sense, it's even like on the level of our portfolio companies, we are trying to help them think about that. How can you build your software in a way that it would require less resources and have less GHG emissions, for example. And that is just one example of when looking at the ESG umbrella, there are a lot of things that can be done inside of it. It's pay equity, it's diversity, it's then climate. So that is the main thing that we see, that we are coming in at a stage when the company normally don't have these practices already in place, and they could survive probably going to like 50 or 100 employees, not having them in place, but building the foundation from the start, both to make then a positive handprint of what is happening for the people working at the company, but also then outside and not having a negative footprint.
Absolutely. The thing I have come across lately is the fact that how much Bitcoin and crypto, kind of classical proof of work cryptocurrencies, how much they actually use energy. That's stunning.
It's stunning. You
kind of would think that it's just software. What can it do? But it's slightly more than just software.
Exactly.
Is Bitcoin the kind of the extreme? I would expect that in the data world, the typical things are still much, much smaller than Bitcoin.
Definitely. Yeah. It's more of a, especially at the stage when where our companies are now, or when at the stage when we invest, in absolute numbers, it's quite small what we're talking about. So it's more about that, how do we build it towards that, then when there are a unicorn and have one of thousands of customers that are using the software daily, that at that stage they wouldn't be going even closer towards the direction where Bitcoin is today.
How much are they ready to listen? How much are they ready to listen? I mean, you know, typically if you're a 20-person company and then investor starts to speak to you about, you know, being ready to be 2,000-person company and set up the processes, I mean...
I would say that it's getting better each year. Okay. That now we're probably at the stage when really nobody like in their personal life have not heard about ESG and how important it is. And it's actually then driving, there's a lot of research also showing how it's driving business success. So it's also like purely in financial terms. So in that sense, I think we're at the right stage for starting to do larger improvements. In the past, we have mainly how we have work together with portfolio companies is that we have this yearly ESG survey that we have also then distributed to portfolio companies where they can see how they track towards the other companies and also what improvements we think there could be on just general suggestions. So that is one thing, and the other is then the work that we do in board meetings. But actually now, because we have realized that it's still quite, as you said, hard to, you have a lot of different things to think about as an entrepreneur, and ESG is probably not highest on your agenda at the stage when we come in. So that's why we have now really put down work on making this framework, having about, I think it's 20 different either KPIs, policies, or then different actions you need to take. And at which stage, which should you do before your 10 people, 10 to 20, and so on. And actually then resources behind this that, for example, for the GHG emissions, we don't think it makes sense to start calculating how many pens are you using and how much emissions are that giving out. But actually we have made this Excel helping out with those big areas, which are around storing data, which is around, and a few two or three other areas, just to help them to make it as pragmatic as possible, but ensuring that when you know even those numbers or know what is your pay equity gap in the company now, then you can start actually making those improvements in the future.
If the startup is listening to us and they are not the open ocean investee, what would be the kind of your tip for the first kind of ESG steps? Where should they first look at to maybe start setting up something like this when they are in their, 10, 20 or 50 people and know that at some point they have to think about it but haven't yet had the time or the energy to do that?
Yeah, that's a super great question. And I would maybe for software companies that are around 15 to 20 people, the things that I would start with having is really these basic policies like code of conduct, having a liability insurance in place, occupational safety and health. Having those already at that stage are super important. And then maybe things that you can start already trying to improve on are probably around pay equity and also board diversity. Those are quite simple things at that stage to already start at least thinking about. And if because, for example, when we come in, it can be that a company is maybe like six persons team. So at that stage, it may be that they are all male in the company and the full board is only males. But that is something to think about when you start then recruiting the, for example, for the management team, that you should, of course, never take a woman or somebody with somebody from another from a diversity group, because they are part of that group. But if you have the possibility to, at least in the beginning of starting the sourcing, to ensure that you have people from different backgrounds, that is always super, super helpful.
Of course. And, you know, in the software sector, you do see, those six-person male startups, you know, every now and then.
Yeah, some of them may be growing to like then maybe 50 people and still having one or two women. And that is not the setup in universities, for example, nowadays. That, of course, it's in the past it was maybe, but not anymore.
Mm. So things are changing. And I think Finland and the Nordics in general are probably, you know, one of their first places to lead that change.
Yeah.
To me, reading that Finland is the 5 or 6 years in a row the happiest nation on the planet Earth, it's shocking. I mean, I understand the welfare logic. I understand the kind of equality and measures like that. But they publish it as a happiness index. Yeah. And yes, you are smiling here when we're recording this podcast. But a typical Finn is not the, you know, maybe the happiness is inside, but you rarely see it outside.
I would agree that it's probably a bit of the same as that. I don't know, I remember exact saying, but that you're not allowed to show that you have money in Finland, for example, that people are driving quite old cars instead of getting a Ferrari, or although you would have the money for it, because it's not considered socially acceptable. So maybe it's the same thing, that we keep the happiness a bit inside and then on the outside show a more of a neutral feeling.
Mm. But I thought the on the background of the kind of the whole ESG thinking and the equality logic, Nordics are clearly showing the example to the rest of the world. You're investing across Europe. Are you able to take the similar approach to the investments in Southern Europe, maybe, or Eastern Europe?
I would say so. Yes, that it's of course you always have to understand the current state from where the entrepreneurs are now. And now I'm not talking about maybe any of our portfolio companies, but also when we meet entrepreneurs, and I can get quite a good sense in the first maybe three meetings that we have with them that, okay, these are quite on a different thinking than us when it comes to ESG. And it's for us, it's then a question during the deal evaluation and the DD, that can we actually come to the same, do we have the same values? If we don't, then probably that could be a reason for not doing the investment.
Mm.
But often the case is that actually when speaking about these things, they realize that, okay, that there are things that could be improved and should be improved, but then you just start from a different starting point than with companies, for example, in Finland.
Exactly. And, often they probably understand that it's actually good for them. It's not that they would do it purely for the investment logic.
No, exactly. And that's, for us, it's important that we try to reduce as much as possible that needs to be done yearly, because of us being an institutional investor. That is, for example, the reason why we now made this big work with the framework, with the upcoming SFDR regulation. We will need to track a lot of different metrics that our portfolio companies will need to track, but we want to help them do it in a pragmatic way instead of them trying to spend a lot of time on it just because it's needed by EU.
Hiring employee number 6 to do the ESG reporting sounds a little bit extensive. No.
No, definitely not. I think actually our thinking is about having a responsible for ESG. That should be around like after 30 employees, but then full time maybe after 100 employees.
Okay.
Yeah,
What's your take on the overall ESG? I think like a few weeks ago, we had the Economist cover saying how ESG is bad for the planet or something along those lines. There's been quite a lot of criticism about the ESG in general. What's your take about those principles?
I think that the term ESG is thrown around a little too much. Myself coming from a very mathematical background, I think the best solution for that is actually having good frameworks, standards, ways of measuring. And although I just said that our portfolio portfolio companies shouldn't do things just because the EU demands, I really think that EU coming with the SFDR regulation is a super good thing because that allows us to really have a common language when talking about these things and having benchmarks to compare against. And then people easily get stuck that it's you can't compare what, for example, a software company does to what an oil company does. And that is, of course, that is clear, but that's not the question. That it's still on all of the aspects of ESG, it's a common joint effort that we need to do. And to be able to do that joint effort, we need to have some ways of measuring it, and we need to have benchmarks per industry so you know how to strive forward. Or are you already now in the top 1%? Then maybe you can focus on some other areas instead. Mm. So I understand where the negative speaking about ESG is coming, and I don't like this greenwashing, for example. I think it's a necessary step, and in 5 or 10 years we will be at a very different stage in the discussion than what we are today.
Mm. And I think also here in the podcast series, many people have talked about the ESG, and many of them have put it in a context that, in principle, the logic is all there. The people are usually talking about some detail, implementation of some detail of the logic in some system, which kind of doesn't mean that the principles are wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
The how about the open ocean and the investments in this field? I mean, what kind of investments have you been making in this kind of the broader ESG sector?
So within that, it's, as mentioned, always something that we do during the due diligence to check that if it's not purely like within the company, but also are they doing something that is improving or causing a positive handprint outside of the company, or of course also ensuring that they are not causing a negative footprint. But when coming to the positive handprint, for example, we have Operations One in Germany that are doing now digital checklists on a very advanced level for manufacturing companies. And those are already now, just when thinking about that, instead of having this 100-page paper manual that you're walking into a factory with, instead having for new hires that this is a quite dangerous step that you're doing, here's a video on how to do it. That is a super great way to ensure that you actually then don't get those injuries in the companies. So that is one thing, for example. Then we have Sunlight, as I mentioned, that is optimizing the edge infrastructure in companies, and therefore reducing then the energy needed. So those kind of indirect, that is, they are not branding themselves as ESG or green companies, but they have a significant
significant impact. They haven't been greenified yet.
Exactly, and we don't want them to be greenified either. But we have also looked then at companies that are more towards the, like for example, this carbon accounting management systems. And of those, we have been close to considered investments in some, but we haven't found a company that would perfectly fit our investment strategy yet. Mm. So it's definitely something that we are looking at. Mm.
And over the last few years, of course, the climate and carbon accounting sector, I mean, it's been kind of a bubble. The valuations before the latest crisis were probably crazy. I'm sure it was probably a good choice to maybe turn down some deals last winter.
Maybe, but I think, yes, that like the worst or the clean tech bubble in the 2000s, that was quite harsh, and a lot of investors burned their fingers. I don't think it's as bad now, but definitely there are areas that are getting a lot of investments, although there maybe doesn't need to be that many solutions in the end. So we have, for example, in the mobility sector, the e-scooters, that there are quite a lot of brands already, and also within the carbon accounting system. Both absolutely solutions are needed, but I think when doing the analysis earlier this year, it's almost half of investments in Europe are going to these kind of solutions within, specifically within climate tech, and that is maybe not the only area that would need it.
Exactly, and it's not probably the area where the problem is the biggest.
Exactly.
The other thing is the carbon trading platforms. There is like a few hundreds of those these days, I think.
Yep. And I would hope that in the future we only have one or a handful that you really can trust, because my problem nowadays is that we definitely need this like objective third party that can handle the trading, but with the large number of traders that there are there, it's super hard for companies to know who they can trust. So that's why, for example, Google are doing their own projects instead of trusting any third party.
And Google, with their massive data centers, is probably a surprisingly large, energy consumer.
Definitely. Mm. And it's also a trickier, myself being also a forest owner, or my family has some forest in the middle of Finland. So it's been interesting to understand from that aspect how much of these, when companies are mitigating their emissions, so what they're doing often is planting trees. And how that is done in quite many cases today is actually that you take down the trees first. And that is just the worst thing you can do, because if you're looking like at the 200, 300 year timeline, it's about the average height of the forest, because that is saying how much emissions the forest can take in. But if you all the time take down the forest and then plant new, it will take like 10 years before you get that's almost
anything back. Exactly. And I think that's one of the risks, clearly. I was talking yesterday with somebody that there would be a good idea to do the calculation if all the forests under the carbon schemes would be cut down and replanted as plantations of the bamboo. Is it bamboo? What's
bamboo,
it?
Yeah.
Yes, the which grows really fast and it kind of also sequesters carbon, but there would be like nothing left in the nature outside those plantations.
Yes. Exactly.
There are a few challenges.
For example, in Finland, it's mandatory. If you take down forest in the next year, you have to put up new or plant new trees, because otherwise you get fined. Mm-hmm. So in one way, there are already these systems in place, and it can be improved. That one thing that I have actually a friend that is working in academia doing research on how to what would happen if you would incentivize the forest owners to keep the forest for 20 years longer than today. So in Finland, we today keep it at 60, 80 years. So instead of keeping it at 80, 10 years. 100
years.
So in that sense, the absolute volume on a 300-year timeline would increase. And that would be much more beneficial than actually taking down and planting trees again, as companies are doing. But there is actually one company in Finland, Collective Crunch, that is thinking about this idea and trying to help being the objective third party with doing the like satellite imaginary for this specifically. But it's super hard, and I think there also for this area needs to be some kind of government regulation coming for it really to be possible for the companies to.
The Single Earth is working on something similar, right?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, exactly. Good stuff. The Finland being the home of the, I don't know, two or three of the top 10 forestry companies of the world, it's a right place to talk about forests. Yes. Even though they go a little bit further from the data focus of open ocean.
Definitely, but it's something that is close to my heart also, like on a personal level. Also, I'm doing this, if you know log rolling. Standing on a log in the water, that was something that was needed like in the 50s when taking the logs down the river to the factories. But nowadays it's just like cultural sport. So we had the Finnish championships in this in a few weeks ago. Wow. And I always try to participate in those.
The Tukki...
Tukkilaisurheilu, yes.
Tukkilaisurheilu, okay. That sounds sounds something rather special.
It's fun.
Yeah. The something from the history. We will add in the show notes a few pictures of this kind of sports. That's definitely worth checking out. It's been done in the North America years ago in the same way with the big forestry sector there. Good. What about kind of looking maybe a few steps in the future with open ocean? What are you guys working on now when we have had the, I don't know, the market crash of the century, or how do they call it, and we're having a war in Europe, which means the energy sector is in trouble, and so on. I mean, how do you guys see the current world around you?
Well, it's of course, especially the war in Europe is a large humanitarian crisis, and it's definitely something we have talked with all our portfolio companies that how can they both help their employees. Some of them had actually employees sitting in Ukraine, so helping both them and their families relocate from there, and also how it affects their business if having companies from customers or potential customers from Russia, and how to handle those situations. As a longer term effect, it's definitely both that and the macroeconomic small crash, at least that we have seen now, have definitely taken down the number of investments done in Europe. I was just checking the PitchBook numbers yesterday, and I think it was about 60-70% of deals, if extrapolating like that this first half year would be the full year, so comparing to the 2021 numbers in early stage. But actually late stage VC hadn't decreased in either number of deals or in the amount of capital put in. So that was quite interesting, because actually when we have spoken with many investors, they late stage investors in the spring, many talked about being now quite careful. Some of them even stopping investing totally. Of course, there are some convertible rounds that have been happening, and that is also something that we have talked with our portfolio companies, that how to ensure that they have the runway that is needed to get outside of this crisis. Yeah. But actually, all of them have a quite good situation, and also for us, when looking at new investments, it haven't affected our investment activity due to the reason that we invest in these more fundamental technologies, which not be as affected by a crisis as if you have a software that is more of a nice to have. For example, having a database, you're not going to switch out your database, but you're going to switch out your vitamins.
From the other end, of course, the most kind of headline grabbing has been the valuation of Klarna.
Yes.
85% down in this crisis, which, I mean, it kind of means two things. One is that there is a crisis, at least in some funding, and it means that at some point their valuation was, you know, heavily bloated.
It was.
Exactly.
Yeah. But it's maybe also, of all respect to Klarna, but it's maybe within those, or it's not within our investment strategy in one way, because there are also other solutions than Klarna that you could switch to. But Klarna has had a like amazing growth in the last years, and of course then it's affected quite a lot if that growth is not proceeding as expected.
Exactly. Good. I think we'll wrap the show if you don't have anything important to add to our listeners.
No, just thanks for having me. It's been super great to talk about this topic. It's definitely a passionate area of mine.
Thanks, Nina. Cheers.
Arma.
Join us again for the next episode. Thank you for listening. If you like the show, please give us a good rating and leave the feedback in your podcast player so others will find it too. We will be back next week. Turn on to Nature-Backed Podcast.
Today is working for me. Do you believe that for yourself? Hey, I'm Pastor Julie, and I want to empower you through encouragement, inviting you to my podcast, Big Truth Encouragement, where I unpack living a faith-filled life. I created my podcast for the ladies, but gentlemen, you'll gain something too. So I invite you to listen to Big Truth Encouragement on Electricast and any platform where you listen to your podcast.
Electricast.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Peter.
We're the founders of Electricast Media, bringing you great podcasts like Nightmare Road Stories, Tech Talk Revolution, and Bodacious Minds.
Electricast networks include Ruby for female empowerment, The Best Business Network, and GPN for geopolitics. We built this company to create community and amplify diverse voices, and we really appreciate your support.
So, keep listening to Electricast podcasts and hear the culture.
Electricast.